This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist magazine. He writes the Badgett column, much to discuss about UK politics, European politics, especially during these transition days between the pandemic and what comes next. He is also the author, most recently, of The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. There's much in this to look today to the struggles of the Johnson government or the Trudeau government or the Biden government or Biden administration, as we say in America. But we begin when Adrian and I were much younger men. His memory of the day of the attack, 9/11/2001. Adrian, a very good day to you. You are in Britain observing the U.S. anticipating our 20th year since the attack. Where were you that day, and what were your thoughts when you first heard of a plane flying into the World Trade Center, and then when you heard of a plane flying into the Pentagon? Good day to you, Adrian.
Good day. Thank you very much for having me on again. On September the 11th, which was a Tuesday, I was sitting in my house, and I was thinking about the article that I was going to write that week for The Economist, which was going to be on George Bush's educational policy. He was making a speech that day on educational policy and his sort of great educational reforms, No Child Left Behind, the soft bigotry of low expectations and the rest of it. So I was meditating on that, and then I took my daughter to school, which was just around the corner. She was very young then. And I came back home, and I just happened to turn the television on. And suddenly I saw what was happening in New York, and then also what was happening in Washington, D.C. So from that moment onwards, the day became a panic, partly because I wanted to see what was happening with my wife and child, partly because I wanted to see what was happening in Washington, D.C., and it was very difficult to navigate around the town. People started streaming out of the town in very large numbers. By the end of the day, there were tanks on the streets in Washington, you know, in case there was any civil disorder or in case there were any other attacks on the city. And then the biggest issue for me at the time as a working journalist was how I was to cover this story, which was, you know, the biggest story of my lifetime. It's still the biggest story of my lifetime. So I was scrambling to do all of those things. So having so many practical problems to deal with sort of slightly distracted me from the, you know, grappling with the sheer enormity of what was going on. And the enormity of what was going on, I lived in Georgetown at that time, and, you know, it was a plane flew into the Pentagon right across the river from us. So it was an extraordinary day, not a history-changing day.
To recover the events of that morning, did you know that the plane had flown into the Pentagon? Did you see the smoke, the debris cloud immediately?
No, I didn't know that. I got a lot of the information from the television. And then, of course, because the plane had flown into the Pentagon, there were questions of whether there were more planes and more coordinated attacks. So the issue of personal and family survival became a very, very, very preeminent one, because we tend to, looking back, we know exactly the number of attacks there were. But at that time, we thought that this was the first of a wave of attacks. And, of course, I was then communicating also with my office in London, and there was a great sense of in London of whether this would come to London as well, and whether it would come to other parts of the world. So people were very petrified that there would be other attacks, and I was certainly very petrified of other attacks. And indeed, of course, there was supposed to be another attack on the White House.
Yes, the transatlantic flights were turned around and sent back, I believe. Did you have any of your colleagues on those planes? Were you concerned about your colleagues?
I didn't have any of my colleagues on that plane, on any of those planes. But the editor of The Economist, strangely enough, that day, Bill Emmett in those days, was actually giving a speech in Yale, and he was stuck in Yale. So he couldn't get back to London, you know, to coordinate the coverage. So the greatest event that occurred during his time as editor, he had to spend watching from New Haven Airport whilst other people back in London, dealt with the coverage.
This is before the iPhone, so of course we were all on devices that seem antique now. Clamshell is my memory, many of those, and text messaging and communications existed, but it was very rudimentary. Did you lose communication at any point during the day? We had trouble in New York because the Verizon phones were off.
Well, I was dealing with, I had a BlackBerry at that point, and I think it went down quite quickly. So what I did actually was to walk to my office, which was near DuPont Circle. So when people were streaming out of the town, I was walking back into the town simply because I needed to be on the phone and in constant communication with the office. And, you know, we didn't come out until Friday, Thursday night. So we had more time than other people to react. We didn't have to do a lot of immediate reaction. But I think the next few days were about, you know, sorting out what was going on when we had endless reports of who's behind this and what the forces at work were and where the attacks was going, where next, you know. So, and the whole magazine, because we have a global staff, so the whole magazine from around the world, particularly in, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and those areas, was very, very much on alert.
Did you get better information from London than you could from the Washington media or the American media?
No, the real source of information at the time, and I think it may be the last hurrah of that particular meeting, was television. The television coverage was unbelievably good and very, very brave, I think. And we got everything from, I think it's probably CNN more than anything else at that time. But the television was real time images of what was happening in New York. But yes, I remember actually I had several friends in New York, who were, there quite near, Ground Zero, as it were. And I talked to them. And then that evening, I remember, I had a collection of people, coming to dinner in my house, some who came from New York. That day, I think it was that evening, or perhaps it was the next day. David Gregory was one of them. John Dickerson was one of them. So it's in my house, because it was quite convenient in Georgetown, became a center of sort of people gathering, you know, just to really to console each other and to try and come to terms with what had happened.
And the memory that I have in Manhattan, and I wonder if you had a similar in Washington, was that it became extremely quiet because there were no aircraft in the air. And the traffic, once it thinned out in Manhattan, you had to walk everywhere because they shut the subways. Can you remember the sounds of Georgetown at the time?
Absolutely, because I lived sort of a bit under the flight path for Reagan Airport, and it was very noticeable how quiet it was. Also, the other thing was that everybody seemed to leave the town. There was a great blockage of cars getting out of the town. I don't know where they went to. And then by the evening, there were a lot of tanks and troops on the street, you know, to prepare for whatever might be happening, particularly near the White House. And of course, the other target at the time, potential target at the time, was the Capitol. Yeah. The Capitol.
Yes.
Was down as well. So there was a great sense of, well, I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my lifetime. So it was an extraordinary moment. And it's extraordinary that both you and I were in the two twin centers in New York.
Yes. And DC. It might be why we're on air today, Adrian. We were there.
Yeah, it may well be. Yes.
My conversation with members of the Bush administration, and most recently Condoleezza Rice, who wanted to remember 20 years, there was an alert late that night that brought the president and the first lady back down to the bunker again. Did you have an alert in Georgetown after hours on the first?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that was the case. But we didn't leave the house. I think we stayed in the house. But yes, there was a constant sense of awareness. So this could be the first of a series of waves of attacks. And do you remember after that, there was a great worry about anthrax, you know, and things like that. So the sense of fear was palpable for a very, very long time after that. And I think, you know, but that was one side of it. But the other side of it was people coming together as a country. And, you know, I've never seen the country more united, just as I've never seen it more divided as it is today. And also in a sense of the heroism of working class people, essentially, who are on the front line, you know, fire workers, police, you know, workers, and people like that. And the extraordinary, one just sat transfixed at seeing this. And well, I won't talk about the people flinging themselves off buildings. So,
yes, there were macabre moments all day long. But this is Adrian Wooldridge remembering when we were younger men, 20 years past.
Indeed.
We're turning now to the politics of the moment, which surprisingly, and start with the attack, 9/11, the people who did it, Afghanistan, and the mystery of the Taliban. Adrian Wooldridge, he is the Economist Badgett columnist. He's in London. The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. It's the story of how we choose our leadership then and now. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.